for the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to Planet Waves FM. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino, your host for about an hour. Tonight I have a special program for you consisting almost exclusively of an interview with a researcher from the Massachusetts Massachusetts Institute of Technology, as well as a journalist from the West Coast. I'll be back in a moment. Welcome to our program. I had said that I would be taking a week off this week, which is mostly true, although I had previously scheduled an interview with a journalist named Jennifer Margulis and a researcher at MIT named Dr. Stephanie Seneff, who got the attention of a lot of people by making an association between Roundup and COVID-19. That got my attention because way back at the beginning of this whole crisis, in my first comment on it on Feb 11, I said, well, it looks to me like we have a situation that's troubling because of the body burden of toxic substances that are, that are in all of us, basically, to some degree or another. And the extent to which Monsanto has been facilitating and profiting from the dumping of Roundup or glyphosate onto basically everyone and everything, and this began in the 1960s, though not with the same kind of vigor that we see today. It's been ramped up, and it's now the front of Monsanto's whole product line, both agricultural and domestic, and so. Anybody willing to talk about the relationship between environmental contamination and the potential results of environmental contamination, who knows something, is welcome as a guest on Planet Waves FM. And I happen to find two individuals who I think are knowledgeable and credible and have some worthwhile ideas to consider. Now, I recognize that this is all basically a counter narrative to what we see going on, which is that the entire world has been attacked by a random strand of RNA that allegedly came from a bat at a vegetable market, which is not true. I keep saying that, and by not true, what I mean is that the whole story of this somehow being transmitted at a market in China, and then the first outbreak at the market, is factually untrue. It doesn't work out. The first cases had no contacts traceable to the Huanan market in Wuhan, China. The disease, assuming it is contagious, was brought to the market by people who were previously exposed, and no one has figured out how they were previously exposed. And yet, over and over again, to the current day, to the current hour, this lie about the Huanan market is being repeated and is currently the only acceptable genesis theory about this scenario. I'm not going to get to the other ones, but if you look on the Planet Waves FM news feed about this called COVID-19 News on planetwaves.fm, up on the top left corner of the screen, you'll see it's COVID-19 News. We've moved in one in honor of halftime of the pandemic, which is what I think we're in right now. You will see that there are many articles about the potential genesis of the SARS-CoV-2 2019, whatever. It's got a bunch of different proper scientific names, but it's this novel coronavirus mutation that we have all been dealing with for much of the year, and which has half the world locked in its hut, home, apartment, palace, sailboat, or hovel at the moment. Okay, so a bit about the counter spin here. The spin, the story as it is being told, and the only story being allowed, is that a virus got out and went wild and suddenly infected billions of people. That's what I've been describing as a story of the figure and not the ground. And ever since this began, in every single broadcast and article that I've written about it, of which there have been many, all available on planetwaves.net. Just look around the front page and you'll see them. And also on the monthly horoscope page, I've been covering it every month. I have been focused on the ground or the background. The ground or the background is the environment itself. It is our bodies. It is our state of health. It is the status of all of the drugs that are being introduced into the human body and the surrounding human environment, from the overuse of antibiotics in both medical conditions and farming conditions, as well as the environmental contamination problem, which rapidly consumes immune resources, and which also is for example, these substances can be genotoxic. They can cause all kinds of hormone disruptions, and all of this eats up immune resources and makes people weaker. There are all kinds of other problems that are associated with this, including the overuse of the flu shot, which is admitted by the Department of Defense to weaken defenses to other viruses. So we have a problem on our hands, and the problem is not merely the novel coronavirus or a hospital bed capacity. The problem is the total holistic health of our environment and of we humans as individuals, and as a teacher of the holistic principle. I mean, you might say that if you take all of the work that I do and think of it as one thing, whether we're talking about my investigative reporting, whether we're talking about my astrology, whether we're talking about my teachings as a sex theorist, it all comes down to one thing, which is the holistic principle, which is that we are part of our environment. Our environment is part of us. We do not exist in separate little bits that can be isolated and treated separately, like, oh, let's fix the liver. Oh, let's fix the pineal gland. There is we are one confluence. The whole is contained in the part. The part is contained in the whole. And we're one thing. That's the holistic principle. Holos, meaning whole. And so that is the approach that I've been taking and the approach that I've been recommending. Of course, I recommend that we use the precautionary principle and follow the basic Centers for Disease Control guidelines, whether they are effective, whether they are useful, whether they're completely ridiculous. I am following them just so I can say that I did, whatever I may think of them. I don't think that going out wearing a mask helps. I don't care if someone's wearing a mask. Please don't spit on me. But I wear the mask anyway. So in any event, then comes everything else we can be doing. Now, one of the criticisms I've had of this whole situation is that there has been so little discussion of what we can do to take care of ourselves and so little discussion of what we can do to prevent making things worse. And so they're related. You know, one of the things I've been saying is, if you want to take care of your immune system, it's as much about what you don't do as it is about what you do. So if you don't consume a lot of chemicals that burn up your immune resources, then you're halfway there, and then you can nourish your body and get enough rest and manage your fear level and your stress level. Okay, so I had a, and I'll end with this story in a fundraising pitch. I had a shocking experience this morning watching CNN, which is on my rounds. You know, I'll flip through the stations, and when I'm done watching a couple of episodes of How It's Made and South Park, I will tune into CNN and see what's going on. And I saw a feature segment that said, oh, by the way, there are ways you can take care of yourself. Maybe you ought to take a little bit of zinc. Chicken soup is good for the immune system. You should make yourself some chicken soup. Very interesting. So they gave a few of these other suggestions of the kind that I've been making, very elementary, but still, finally, someone, after all these days and days and days and days and days and stock market losing a third of its value and all of this stuff, finally, I saw a feature on television that said, you can take care of yourself. Why don't you think about doing that? It lasted about 2 minutes and it was over, and I wonder if I'm ever going to see it again. And one of the things I found the most appalling about this whole scenario is that in the instruction set for taking care of ourselves, we're basically at the 1918 level. Wear a mask, social distancing, don't sneeze and cough on people, wash your hands, you know, don't go to mass events. That's social distancing. And if you get sick, you're going to lay in the hospital being given Tylenol. In 1918, it was aspirin. That killed a lot of people. I believe Tylenol is killing a lot of people now. And if you get really sick, we're going to shove a tube down your throat. And that's basically all medical science and all of its divinely inspired wisdom has to offer us. And what I have also been saying, and I'll say it one more time, is that if you're concerned about any of this, you would be wise to identify the naturopathic, homeopathic, and herbalist practitioners in your community and make an appointment and find out what they have to say to you. In today's interview, we have two people who have invested a fair amount of time, energy, and I would say credibility in attempting to ascertain, not only in this situation, but over the years, the health impacts of glyphosate, that is to say Roundup, a very poisonous chemical on many different levels, and we will speak more about that during the interview, which lasts about 50 minutes or so, and then I go out with a song. While I have your attention, Planet Waves FM is funded exclusively by your donations. We do get one modest contribution from a family foundation. This person is an actual direct listener of the program, so it's not something that came in through some abstract thing or filing a grant application. And then every other penny we get comes either from you or from me. So I would be most grateful, understanding that there's something like 22 million newly unemployed people, but that doesn't include everyone. And if you are listening and you come back every week and you count on me for a space of calm and the point of view that I offer, please do click on that link at the top of the page and make a contribution to Chiron Return. That is the nonprofit corporation that sponsors the program. And then if you are not in a position to make a financial contribution, you're welcome to help out, and please do pass the program forward. Okay, without any further comment, I would like to enter the interview portion of the program where I properly introduce my guests, and we'll take it from there. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll catch you next week. I'd like to welcome to Planet Waves FM Dr. Stephanie Seneff from MIT and a journalist and author named Jennifer Margulis out on the West Coast. Dr. Seneff is a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory in Cambridge. I'd like to visit that place. She has a BS from MIT and a PhD from MIT in electrical engineering and computer science. Her recent interests have focused on the role of toxic chemicals and micronutrient deficiencies in health and disease, with a special emphasis on our favorite chemical here at Planet Waves FM, Roundup, and the mineral sulfur. She's authored over 30 peer-reviewed journals in the past few years on these topics. And Jennifer Margulis is an award-winning journalist, Fulbright grantee, and sought-after speaker. As we can tell, we've sought after her, and here she is. She's the author of Your Baby, Your Way, Taking Charge of Your Pregnancy, Childbirth, Parenting, and Decisions for Happier, Healthier Family. And she's also co-author of The Vaccine Friendly Plan. She's been researching and writing about health-related issues for over 15 years and has worked on a child survival campaign for West Africa and done lots of other things. Ladies, welcome to Planet Waves FM. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You're right. Most welcome. So we were sent your stuff like 100 times, basically, on the Roundup thing, because you had done some writing linking possibility of Roundup exposure to disease, including COVID-19. And of course, not everyone in society is at equal risk when something like this happens. It's kind of like if somebody were to start shooting at a football game, people inside wouldn't get hit. If you're standing behind a pillar, you're not going to get hit. And it's very similar when a disease like this or health crisis moves through society. Not everyone is at equal risk.
Right.
And so you've been looking at some of the potential other risk factors. Stephanie, do you want to tell us what you've been doing and what you've been observing, and bring that into the Roundup connection?
Right. Yes. Well, of course, I've been obsessed with Roundup now for several years, and I really believe it's a major player in the health crisis that we're seeing in the United States and increasingly around the world, the autism epidemic and Alzheimer's and various cancers and gut problems and all of these things that we're seeing. I think glyphosate's a major player. I mean, we have a lot of toxic chemicals in our environment, but I have really singled that one out, and it's frustrating because we believe it's perfectly safe. We think it's a wonderful herbicide. It kills all plants except for those that have been engineered to resist it, and it's completely harmless to humans, and that's a bit hard to believe, in my opinion. I'm amazed that people just take that at word value, and when Monsanto says this chemical is great, it's safe, people simply believe that. And of course, the regulators seem to believe it too, and therefore it's all over the place. It's not regulated. You know, anybody can buy it. They can put it on their dandelions in front of their children, and they don't realize it's toxic. So we're just making a huge mistake with massive poisoning with this chemical, especially in the United States, which uses more per person than any other country in the world.
I saw a map once that basically illustrated the average application of Roundup over the past 20 years. Maybe you've seen this map. It was a map of the United States, and like the Roundup was going to be illustrated in purple, and then by like 2015, the whole country was purple.
I know. It's scary, isn't it? I've seen that whole series of time series of over the years, and just showing how more and more, and in fact, it's going up. The usage has been going up exponentially of Roundup, and the incidence of autism has been going up exactly in step with the rise in glyphosate. Those two curves coincide. It's an incredibly strong correlation between those two curves. And people say, oh, correlation doesn't mean causation. We can ignore this, which really shocks me, because it's the same is true for things like dementia and pancreatic cancer. I mean, all of these diseases that are going up dramatically, and we're somehow fine with that. We don't see that there's a problem that we're all getting, and we're getting fat, too. I mean, the obesity epidemic is directly connected to glyphosate, I believe. You know, people don't seem to be willing to connect those dots, which really confuses me, actually.
It does.
Because it seems so obvious to me.
Yeah, I gave a rant on my program last week about the things people care about and the things that they don't care about. And you can spray poisons from the sky, and you could wind up with somewhere around 47% of people getting cancer, and you can have heart disease running rampant and fast food being sold, and people demand their right to eat fast food and harm themselves. And then now we've just shut down society over allegedly over this virus.
Right.
It's confounding.
I'm hoping that COVID-19 has a silver lining, because I really hope that this is enough to wake people up. I don't know what it takes, and it's too bad that it takes an entire shutdown of world economy. And even with that, people still are not willing to believe that it might be the toxic chemicals that are making people sick.
I mean, forget about it. Why don't we just consider the possibility, honestly?
I know, that's right. I agree. Right? At least consider the possibility. People are like, oh, no, this won't, you know, they just consider me to be nuts, basically. I mean, it's frustrating, I have to say.
No, well, welcome to the Lunatic Fringe. I mean, and if we look at having been
Wait
here.
Wait a second. I don't think I put myself in that category.
So I say this endearingly, that if you look at Monsanto's history, right? I mean, these are the people who gave us PCBs. They gave us Agent Orange. They gave us DDT. They gave us the Copper 7. They were involved in the atomic bomb project. And then they basically invent this whole GMO thing. And when they can't sell the seeds, they convert the whole thing to Roundup Ready to sell Roundup.
Yeah, I know. It's quite a story, isn't it?
So, yes, it's kept me busy since around 1991.
You've been at it longer than I have.
There were transformer explosions in my town. I was editing a student news service, and the campus blew up. And that seven transformers went off, and that got me into it. And I had new purpose. So what are your observations and what data have you been tracking that can start to put together this health crisis with the COVID, rather with the Roundup crisis?
Right, and it turns out to be very interesting, and it's stuff I wasn't actually aware of until very recently, which is the a very big development in the area of biodiesel fuel that's been happening over the past decade. And especially in the past couple of years, so people have really been rolling out this, you know, they've been learning how to do it, and now they've been increasing the number of manufacturing plants where they take biomass, you know, just materials that are, in some cases, just sort of the leftovers once you harvest the crop, and you put it through this process, and you produce a fuel that behaves like diesel, and you can add it to diesel fuel for vehicles that run on diesel. You augment them with this biodiesel, which helps to, you know, reduce petroleum consumption, and allegedly actually improves the carbon dioxide situation. So people are motivated to do it for a good reason.
Yes.
And what's really sad is that they're not realizing what I think is happening is that they're ending up with glyphosate in that fuel, because it's all of the different sources that I've found for this biodiesel fuel. Yeah. Can be explained as having glyphosate exposure. Things
canola,
like
corn, soy are all a GMO.
Yeah, and then wheat is sprayed right before harvest. So the U.S. is using the remnants of the crop once they harvest the wheat. They spray it right before harvest. Ooh. They harvest it. They give us celiac disease with that glyphosate-contaminated wheat. And then they take the residue and throw it through this machinery that ends up burning glyphosate in the fuel tank and releasing it into the exhaust fumes. So I think that people in cities like New York City are in serious trouble, because New York City has played a leadership role in rolling out this biodiesel fuel. They're really top in the country in that space. They've got several plants around that city that do this, that convert these biomass into fuel. And then they have like 11,000 vehicles on the road in the city running this on this stuff. So I think people in New York are breathing toxic air, which is damaging their lungs and then setting them up for failure once they get a viral infection. Their lungs are not able to properly react. Their immune system is busted by glyphosate, and they're not able to properly react to these viruses. They can't control them. They end up releasing a lot of cytokines, which destroy the lung tissue and cause you to not be able to breathe.
Can we talk about the immune system damage of Roundup? And can I tell you how I understand it to be, and tell me if I've got that right?
Okay.
Okay, so Roundup is, as we know, absolutely perfectly harmless, except for a few things, one of which is that it kills gut flora. And that because it's on the level of the plants that it's targeted to, so there's sufficient similarity or whatever, it's susceptible, and it knocks out the gut flora, and the gut flora is the heart and soul of the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And so with compromised gut flora and then acting on the intestines, you have other problems. the immune system is compromised, and that's one of the most serious problems of Roundup exposure.
I agree. I completely agree with that.
Okay.
And there are other issues as well. Glyphosate disrupts the antioxidant defenses. That's been shown in multiple studies. Things like glutathione, you know, which is very important for protecting the cells from oxidative damage. What happens is the innate immune system is being harmed by glyphosate, and in part that's through disrupting the gut microbes. And then the adaptive immune system kicks in and releases these cytokines, which cause oxidative damage. And if the cells were equipped with sufficient glutathione, they could counter that damage and put out the fire, but they can't because that's also affected by the glyphosate. So it's messing up the surfactant proteins, or at least that's what was shown. I mean, what really fascinated me and what made me write this article, actually, was when I found an article on mice, that an experiment where mice were exposed to the fumes, the vapors of vaping cigarettes. You know how they have these e-cigarettes?
Yeah.
And there was this, and I was aware of this actual strange lung disease that was showing up among e-cigarette users. I was aware of that before COVID-19. I was fascinated by it because I suspected it might be due to glyphosate. And what's really interesting is that the e-cigarettes have glycerol in them, and the glycerol is actually manufactured from the remnants of the plants where the biodiesel fuel comes out.
Oh,
so first
please.
They produce the biodiesel.
No.
Yeah, and then with the remnants, they produce glycerol. They put that into the cigarette. So you're smoking glyphosate in your cigarette. And the paper showed that it wrecks the surfactant proteins in the lungs. They showed it experimentally with these mice. And the mice got a really bad reaction to a flu infection. So they exposed them to these vapors for 3 months. And then they gave them a flu infection, and they got really sick. They got much sicker than the control mice. It's a beautiful experiment, you know, that really hits exactly the story I'm trying to tell with respect to glyphosate that you're breathing from the exhaust fumes.
Let's when we correspond after we record, I'll get the citation to that study.
Mm-hmm.
That is vexing, and I had no idea they were using GMO remnants of the biodiesel process to make the crap in e-cigarettes.
You have to worry about where things come from. I've been looking up patents on various manufacturing to try to figure out if there's possibility of glyphosate. When I see something that's causing trouble, I have to go back to the patents to find out exactly how they're making this. You know?
Jennifer, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, I am sure that you have incredibly sophisticated and well-read listeners, but it would be, as someone who is not a scientist, sometimes I think it helps to unpack things a little bit.
Please
so,
go for it.
Yeah.
I just wanted to chime in that, you know, everyone is absolutely terrified about this COVID-19 and this virus. And we've seen this throughout human history that we can have some really devastating infections. They're either viral or bacterial. They have different ways of spreading. So like bubonic plague, which was, you know, the Black Death, or leprosy. I mean, all sorts throughout human history, we've had this problem, right? But the question is, I think the mainstream media and our health officials tend to focus on this evil virus that might kill us all, and we have to conquer it. We have a war against it. And I think one of the things that Dr. Senef and you and I is saying is that however virulent an infection is going to be, humans have actually evolved to cohabitate with viruses, fungi, bacteria. That's a strange idea for a lot of people. Wait, what are you talking about? We cohabitate with, quote, germs. That
germs, we are germs. You know, our mitochondria is germs.
Yeah, so bacteria, right? We are actually, I like to think of ourselves as these walking human skyscrapers of bacteria.
Libraries,
and
yes,
viruses. But so then the question becomes, what a virus or a bacteria or any infecting agent wants to do is not kill the host. And what we're honestly all afraid of is not getting sick, but getting desperately ill or dying. So then the question is, what are the factors that contribute to having a healthy host? You know, I'm calling humans hosts right now. And one of the things that Dr. Senef said that I really want to underscore is this question of glutathione. And I don't know that all of your listeners know what that is. But, you know, I like to explain it as glutathione is nature's mop. It's something that binds, you know, like you mop your kitchen floor and you get the dirt out. So if we have toxic exposures, if we have good ways of detoxing, if we are able to excrete the toxins that we're exposed to, those toxic exposures are not going to hurt us, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that Dr. Seneff is saying is that we have to have good glutathione in order to process toxic exposures and infections and everything else. And that's one of the things that we're seeing with people who have compromised lung function, who's at risk for dying of COVID-19, mm-hmm. people with lower glutathione, including mm-hmm. older adults and smokers. And one of the other things that I really need to point out that is compromising our glutathione levels is acetaminophen. So mm-hmm. worldwide now, doctors are telling people to take Tylenol. Okay. So if you have a fever or an infection, they're saying that with COVID-19, ibuprofen isn't safe, and so you should take Tylenol. And I want your listeners mm-hmm. to know that that's absolutely the worst advice you could ever give to anyone. And the fact that we are actually giving people Tylenol, I think, is criminal. Because what does Tylenol do? It actually binds up the glutathione. It compromises your ability to detox. And so it's very possible, and there was just an article in the British Medical Journal to this effect, saying that one of the reasons why we're seeing such high death rates in some places may also be the aggressive use of acetaminophen.
Yep. A couple of things on that. One is, this reminds me of the Spanish flu, where they were overdosing people on aspirin. In an attempt to suppress the fever. And I've been talking a lot about suppression and why that's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. I did not know about the glutathione, but I do know a doctor who works on a liver team down in Oklahoma City. She's one of my astrology clients, and she said that she's the psychiatric consultant on the liver team. And she knows for sure that if you are on too much Tylenol and you drink alcohol, or if you're drunk and you take Tylenol, you can need a liver transplant from one episode.
Right.
Is that related to the glutathione issue? She said it's an immune system issue. It's a system A, system B issue, she said.
Right. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Go ahead, you go first, and then I'll.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I actually wrote a paper tying acetaminophen to autism through the MMR vaccine, that people were being administered acetaminophen to control the fever in MMR. And acetaminophen is toxic to the liver, very toxic to the liver. It's one of the worst drugs affecting the liver, especially because of glyphosate, because glyphosate disrupts a class of enzymes in the liver called the cytochrome P450 enzymes, which are very good at breaking down other toxic chemicals. So when those are weakened by glyphosate, acetaminophen becomes more toxic. And Jennifer's absolutely right that the acetaminophen depletes the glutathione, and then the glutathione depletion causes an inability to react to the oxidative damage that's produced because the immune system is weak. So you've got a huge cascade of problems there that are causing people to get taken down by COVID-19 due to their exposures to these toxic chemicals.
See, this is I think, in terms of who lives and who dies and who gets sick and who doesn't, obviously there is some differential. I do not believe this is just random. And it would be nice to know, to have real postmortems. But of course, postmortems may not measure those things. If they find Tylenol, they're not going to say that, you know? I mean, it's not a factor of mortality.
I wish they would be looking at these things more carefully because this needs to come out. I'm hoping that there will be some studies, and there already have been some good studies. I mean, studies from China that have shown people who have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease had an 18-fold increased risk of ending up in the ICU if they caught COVID-19.
Well, that's not shocking.
In a study out of China.
I mean, that alone, that makes perfect sense. I mean, they're having trouble breathing as it is.
Having trouble breathing. But, of course, that's also linked to cigarette smoking.
Yes,
smokers are also...
Right. So. Yeah, COPD isn't just grow out of nothing. Jennifer?
Oh, no, I just wanted to say, just going back one more minute to Tylenol, it's important to realize that it's in over 600 prescription and over-the-counter medications. And actually, Eric, you might not know that even just a double dose of Tylenol can cause liver toxicity. So, you know, it's one of the main reasons that people end up in the emergency room for liver problems. And people don't realize if they have a cough, say they have COVID-19 or similar symptoms, they have a cough, they take their cough medicine at night. That includes acetaminophen. They wake up an hour later and they've got a burning fever, and then they dose themselves with acetaminophen right then. they're already overdosing, and it's so toxic that even just a double dose can hurt you.
Without the alcohol, without being drunk.
That's what I'm trying to tell you is, yes, without the alcohol, without being drunk. And that's pretty, I mean, the FDA has a big warning. That's pretty common knowledge, although you sound surprised, so I guess it's not as out there in the ether as I thought it was. But, you know, people know, and in fact, this is very sad, but if you are looking for a way to commit suicide, people, if you Google Tylenol and suicide, you see that people
do that.
Actually use that.
Oh, God.
It's not a good idea. It's a terrible, terrible way to commit suicide, so don't let me give anybody any ideas. But I'm just saying that people understand that it can cause severe liver failure very quickly and easily.
And it is like life-saving in the sense that it's an over-the-counter drug. It's very popular, very common. People think it's innocent, right? People develop a faith that it's not as harmless just because it's so common and so easy to get.
Yes, and in this case, I think it's sort of a miracle drug. I mean, I'm very disturbed by the information that, you know, sales of acetaminophen have absolutely skyrocketed worldwide. That's exactly what we don't want to see. And so then we have to ask this question, you know, why are Americans so unhealthy? And what are the contributing factors that are making so many people so sick when they get this disease? And I don't want this to mean that I'm somehow, I think that we can tend to get into this thing, like, I don't blame people for getting sick. And you can't, you know, you can't say it's your fault that you got sick. I think that we have a system failure here where we have a public health system that is not paying attention to the data. We have good, high-quality, peer-reviewed scientific data showing these problems. In Dr. Sennett's article, there are 38 citations that you read, Eric. And, you know, the vast majority of them, I think 35, are from peer-reviewed scientific articles talking about how glyphosate disrupts the immune system and harms human health. And then people like to dismiss it and say, oh, that's just ridiculous. That's not possible. They don't use any science to be dismissive. But they just say, oh, it's not possible. Everybody uses it. It must be safe. And then we say, well, look, here's 35 citations to show you that it's not. And then they close their brains and they close their minds. And we're back stuck in a country with very poor public health outcomes.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I'm amazed that you see the glyphosate ads running back to back on late night television with the law firms suing for the popular weed killer. It was like that with testosterone for a while. They had the testosterone drugs running all night long. Then they started mingling law firm ads about the class action suit. And then they all went away. It's like, oh, Fine. Someone tell me what happened. Now the glyphosate ads, I sent you one in our email thread. CNN is sponsored by glyphosate ads.
Great. That's just great.
I mean, we had juror number four. So I've been covering Monsanto since the 90s, and Carol, my teacher, has been covering it since the 70s. And so we're aware of the IBT lab study. Well, first of all, you know, it went through IBT labs, which is this fraudulent testing lab, and it was probably never retested. But one of the things to be recertified, but one of the problems was that even the inert ingredient in glyphosate causes the testicles of rabbits to fall off. The inert ingredient.
Yeah, the inert ingredient is acutely found to be 1,000 times more toxic than glyphosate, acutely. Glyphosate has a subtle, insidious mechanism of toxicity that I talk about in my papers, but the actual acute exposure, glyphosate is quite benign compared to the things that are added to the formulations. And those things are not even studied. The regulators don't even care about them.
If it's called inert,
they're not even considering it. Yeah, POEA, for example, they add these adjuvants or these surfactants that both increase the uptake of glyphosate into the cells, but also are toxic in and of themselves. They're acutely toxic. Papers have shown that.
What does a surfactant do in this case?
Surfactants mess up the cell's membrane. You know, they get into the membrane and mess it up and cause lots of bad things to happen that kills the cells, but they also enable glyphosate to get into the cell.
Well, so basically, do they break surface tension? Is that the thing that it does?
Yeah, I think that's right, yep.
Okay.
They sort of cause the chemical to stick better to the plant, which is what they're used for in the...
Just to adhere to the roots and to the stems so that
it stays there and get in as opposed to getting washed off.
So it's going to break through the plant's surface barrier defenses to, that, that prevent
yeah, exactly.
alien
and it
things
gets
from
through
getting
our surface barrier defenses as well, and the microbes' defenses. It gets through everybody's defenses. So
this is important to know about glyphosate, which is that part of what it does is it has built in a process to break down the things that living, normal, healthy biology would defend itself against, and it's going to do the same thing in people.
Yeah, well, the surfactants, the extra ingredients in the formulation, those ingredients actually don't end up in the food supply the way glyphosate does. So glyphosate ends up in the food supply by itself without those, but that still is very, very toxic. I believe it's getting incorporated into the proteins, and that's what's making gluten be so toxic. So we have an epidemic in gluten intolerance. I've written a paper about that together with Anthony Samso, where we nailed it to claim that glyphosate is what's causing that epidemic.
So let's
glyphosate in the wheat.
Can we think about that for a second? There is no Roundup Ready wheat, though, as far as I understand. Is there?
No, but it's sprayed right before harvest quite routinely as a desiccant right before harvest. So it has even higher levels. Wheat-based foods have higher levels of glyphosate in many cases than the GMO crops that are engineered to resist it.
Jennifer?
Oh, I was just going to say that's interesting. You know, I have a friend who goes back and forth between the United States and Europe, and she has a terrible intolerance to so many foods when she's in the United States, and then when she goes back to her small community, and I think it's in France, she can go ahead and eat wheat again. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea if it's because of the way that it's being processed or the extra contaminants, but it's like it's so striking to her that she has these terrible bowel issues, yep. You know, in America that she doesn't have when she's back in her home country.
I mean, I can confirm that. I have celiac. I'm diagnosed before it was cool. And when I lived in Germany, it's true. And I'm from Brooklyn before it was cool. And when I lived in Germany, I ate Dinkel, I ate Spelt, and I was absolutely fine. And in the United States, even the least bit of wheat sends my entire body spinning. I can be knocked out for a day or 3 days or a week from one exposure.
That is amazing.
So this really, I guess I hit the jackpot in that my theory that this is environmental illness that we're talking about.
Yes.
That, as you said, the bad boy is being said to be this SARS-2 COV-2019 RNA that we're all hiding in our homes from, and people are wearing bandanas outside and all that stuff. And I'm thinking of this as a figure versus ground issue, where the figure that we're looking at dancing around on the stage with the sunglasses and the spotlight is coronavirus, this novel coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
But the real information, as one of my philosophical heroes, Marshall McLuhan, explained, comes from the background. The thing in the front is usually a distraction in some way. If you want to know what's going on, you look at the background.
Mm-hmm.
The example I give is a fish tank. Just to tell me if I'm on here. When your fish aren't acting right in the fish tank, you test the water. You don't test the fish.
Mm. Right? Yeah, I love that. Enough.
pH and you check the salt salinity, and you check the nitrates and the whatever that thing is, ammonia, and then you adjust.
Mm-hmm.
You don't cut a fish open.
That, absolutely, and we should talk about that because there are multiple factors that are going into what's making our fish tank sick.
At the moment, yes, the big fish tank of the planet.
The planet is the fish tank, and you know, one of the major contributors is the quality of food that we eat. I mean, most Americans aren't eating food; they're eating what Michael Pollan calls edible food-like substances.
I like that name.
Yeah. Humans are tremendously resilient that, I mean, I can speak for my own family, like one of my children, I won't say which, will just start shoveling stuff that they get from the Dollar Tree down their gullet. It's a terrible thing. And I can't, I have teenagers and you learn the hard way that you can't control what they do.
No.
But you just hope that, 95% of the time they're eating healthy food. But, we're not even, people feel like they can't afford organic food. And I sympathize tremendously with that feeling. At the same time, people aren't even eating food to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So we have what, doctors are calling a very pro-inflammatory diet just at the very beginning. humans are also incredibly vitamin D deficient because we're not going outside and we're not getting into the sunshine. We're so toxic. Babies are born with a body burden of toxicity that
yep.
has astounded researchers
yep.
because they feel like a newborn coming into the world shouldn't be, you know, that toxic to begin with. So you're absolutely right when you say it that way, that our planet, that our environment is a huge factor in what's causing us to be sick. And we also have what a researcher at Duke University calls a depleted microbiome. You know, you were talking earlier about your good gut flora, and you know, what that means is that we have bacteria that are on the front line of our immune defense. And when we don't feed them with healthy probiotic food that helps them flourish, and when we have a depleted microbiome, when we aren't getting dirty enough with healthy dirt, not with things like glyphosate, you know, we're also disrupting immunity. So all of these things are playing a huge factor into what we're seeing now as a global pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, it's interesting because both South Korea and Germany are doing pretty well in this COVID-19 nightmare. They're doing considerably better than many other countries. And both of them consume considerable amounts of fermented cabbage, the kimchi mm-hmm. in South Korea and the sauerkraut in Germany.
Yeah.
And I suspect that may be very helpful for them both in terms of the bacteria that they're getting, the probiotics. And also the sulfur in the cabbage. Cabbage is a very healthy food. It has a lot of sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I suspect, and this has not been proven, but it's true that acetobacter, which are in those products, there are species of acetobacter that are able to fully metabolize glyphosate. So I've theorized that fermented food is actually providing their oral cavity with a microbe that can break down the glyphosate.
That
wow.
is interesting. Well, when this whole thing came out, one of the first places I went was the kimchi farm. We have a kimchi farm. I live up in the sticks in New York State, and there's this Korean family that makes a lot of kimchi, and I'm getting it in half-gallon jars. And
that's awesome.
You know, I announced like a month and a half ago that I'm basically living on kimchi miso soup these days. And at our local health food store, there's one like refrigerator cabinet that includes all the kimchi and the miso in one place.
Uh-huh.
And I'm noticing there's no toilet paper, but no one's buying out the kimchi refrigerator. I'm disappointed. I thought I was gonna have to like fight for people to get my bottle of miso, but they're fully stocked with like 10 kinds of miso. The food we eat, I think, is essential to the fish tank. That's the fish tank, and I'm with you. I'm thrilled to hear that they're getting results on what you're calling fermented cabbage, which is basically kimchi, sauerkraut. They're all assuming it's live. They're basically the same thing. And I have been encouraging my listeners to eat well, to eat real food, and to take this opportunity to eat real food, not rich food, but real food.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's crucial. Get out in the sunlight, eat real food, stay away from the highways, and you'll be okay, I think, if you get COVID-19.
Yes.
And I would say that's an especially important message, too, to give to parents and to pregnant women that, you know, I had a friend who was pregnant and said, oh, I can eat a pint of Ben and Jerry's every week and not gain. And I'm only gaining a pound a week or something like that. And I remember thinking, but why would you want to be feeding your baby a pint of Ben and Jerry's?
Good
you
heavens.
Know, and the thing is, and people do pay a lot more attention to their diet when they're pregnant and they start to change their habits. It's a good change point. But I think that, you know, pregnant women and families and small children, people with small children, that's the thing I was talking about teenagers just a second ago. But before, when your child is younger, before, say, age 10 or 11, you really do have a tremendous amount of control over what they eat, and you just don't bring food into the house that isn't food. You just, you know, when a child wants a snack, you give them a banana. It comes in its own packaging. It's very easy to carry and portable. If they need something crunchy, you feed them some green beans, you know, as fresh as possible, or snow peas, or a carrot. You know, a snack doesn't have to be a hot fudge sundae. A snack can be colorful vegetables, and you can have a lot of fun with that. Like, it doesn't, that's the thing, is that in order to be healthy, you don't have to be a police officer, and you don't have to be sour and sober. You can, you know, there's so many absolutely incredible foods to eat, like go to the store and get a dragon fruit, or try a mango if you've never had one before. You know, you scorate them and you turn them upside down and they look like tortoise shells, and then you eat them right there off that mango half. And I think that instilling a love of healthy eating and good, nutritious, delicious food is a huge step that we can all take to improve our health. And also glyphosate free. I mean, as much as possible, it has to be free from herbicides and pesticides, and whether that means it's certified organic. And I know even if you're eating organic, you still are not necessarily eating, quote, clean. Mm-hmm. But trying as much as you can and finding ways to afford it. And also, we all, I think, have to really advocate for real food to be affordable for every person mm-hmm. on the planet.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, we have a lot of people unemployed right now. It seems to me we could put them to work pulling weeds in the organic crops and not have to use the chemicals, right?
You know, if people are fortunate enough to have farms near where they live, I mean, there's food deserts, and then there's cities which are kind of their own kind of food desert, in that none of the food is very, very local from a very large city. Mm-hmm. I some of our farmers up here go down to Manhattan to participate in the farmers markets, but most people don't shop at farmers markets. So I would put that first on the list of places to shop if you want to improve your fish tank. Go to the farmers market, because you can usually talk to the person who grew the potato.
Absolutely.
Like to talk to the guy who grew the potato, you know, or the girl who milks the goats or whatever it is, and find out, you know, what's going on. That's the beauty, I think, of the farmers market, especially if they're a local market.
Right, it's great.
They come right
and
up.
It's really wonderful to see that farmers markets have really caught on, because they were not really even part of the landscape not that long ago.
No, 10-15 years ago. Few. Nope, they were just starting to catch on.
That's been a great improvement, I think. It's a move in the right direction that we have farmers markets now.
Yes, much better than shipping a peach 4,000 miles.
Right, and eating local is a good idea. You know, I always try to be local poor, but then on top of being certified organic, sometimes that combination doesn't work.
Well, that's because you're in the Boston area, right, Stephanie? Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, I'm blessed to be out. I'm talking to you from the West Coast, and I live in Southern Oregon, which has absolutely phenomenal microclimates for growing almost anything. And so it's very easy to get affordable, local, pesticide-free food here, which is wonderful. And in fact, yesterday they opened the farmers market. Everybody practiced appropriate social distancing. They delayed the opening of it, so it was very nice to see that the farmers got to bring their produce directly to the people.
That's awesome.
Now, you had mentioned pesticide-free. I think that the term organic is in many ways, it's either misleading, it's subject to overcharging, and it's also a kind of a byword. And that... So one of the things I talk to farmers about is what they actually do with pesticides. What are their actual practices? When are things sprayed? What's their rationale for spraying? What are they spraying? As opposed to organic. So there's going to be a lot of things produced by small farmers that are not organic, but that are much better than things you might pick up off of the mass food chain.
Right.
Sprayed with many, many fewer chemicals.
And of course, there are farmers that are too small to do the organic certification. Costs a lot of money.
Yes.
Some small farmers can't afford it. And I do trust farmers. And we spend time in Hawaii, and they will say, I don't use any chemicals, but I'm not certified. Mm-hmm. And I'll go ahead and buy that food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jennifer.
The flip side of that is true, too, Eric, which is that something can be labeled organic, or it can be labeled, quote, gluten-free. And we think of those as buzzwords, that those mean healthy. And just because it's organic, when it's a... You know, when it's a Pop-Tart and the first three ingredients are all sugar, that doesn't make it healthy at all. You know, there's you know, there's ways to eat much healthier without being organic, and people really, even really smart, really educated people make the mistake of thinking that organic means healthy, and it just doesn't. You know, food is food. Food is healthy when you eat
yes.
it and it's living and it's real. When you eat packaged crap, you're eating dead substances that aren't promoting your healthy immune system.
Mm-hmm. Now,
the other thing to realize is non-GMO is not a good enough label. A lot of people think, oh, non-GMO, that's great, I'll buy it. Non-GMO can have even more glyphosate in it than GMO products.
Yeah.
You know, because of the spraying right before harvest. People need to be aware of that.
Yes.
Non-GMO is not a good enough label if you're trying to avoid glyphosate.
Yeah, you've got me on two issues. Caught me on Tylenol. I wasn't aware of the warnings that were involved or how low of a dose. You know, my friend Teresa told me, warned me about the, you know, tell people not to take it when they're drunk. And you're saying much, much worse than that. And then
I've actually never taken Tylenol. I refuse to take it my entire life.
Well, it always reminds me of the, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the Tylenol poisoning episode.
Right. Yes.
Where someone just, you know, put cyanide or something in six or seven bottles of Tylenol, and people were a lot of people died, and they recovered
right,
from that,
that
amazingly.
Crazy.
Talk about brand resiliency.
I know, that is amazing. I remember that. That was really shocking that someone would even do something like that. You know.
Yeah, and it was, and then
but
the other one.
People switched to Tylenol because of aspirin. There was that whole issue about aspirin with the children. You know, that aspirin was dangerous, and then that really brought on a great increase in the use of Tylenol, which showed up in terms of illness. You know, the Tylenol was toxic.
Yeah. Jennifer?
I was just going to say that two fascinating things. One is that if you look at the cohort studies for after that Tylenol poisoning incident, and you look at incidence of brain damage, encephalitis, encephalopathy, and autism, you actually see a dip. So, and also if you look at, I mean, this is all sort of epidemiological data that isn't necessarily, you know, sort of strong, hard science. But if you look at the Cuba also, which is a place where people don't use as much acetaminophen, you see much, much lower rates of autism. So the researcher who I was talking about at Duke University is named William Parker, and he's been doing for years looking at the toxic effects of acetaminophen, and he feels that really strongly, I mean, based on, you know, more than 12 peer-reviewed science articles, none of which are really high quality, I would have to say, because I've read them all. But that if we overnight stopped using acetaminophen, stopped giving it to children, that we would see a huge improvement in human health, and that we would see a huge decline in autism in children, which I think is a fascinating hypothesis. And I don't know, honestly, why we don't have a black box warning on. We've gone this long with this toxic a drug and with no warning and no understanding in the mainstream of how bad it can be.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And I wonder, you know, who makes it and the process that it went through. We have a similar situation with aspartame. Aspartame was held up for years due to the brain tumor issue. And then the guy who became Secretary of Defense under Bush II was also the FDA leader under Reagan. And he got a NutraSweet Monsanto product originally. He got that through. And the last time I checked, which was quite a while ago, there were 20,000 cases of neurotoxic incidents, brain seizures, and other neurotoxic incidents associated with NutraSweet aspartame. Yeah, and it too is in the coatings of pills. It's in ice cream. It's in soft drinks. It's in everything.
Mm.
And it's astonishing that this is allowed to stay on the market. I'm the little kid in me who's always watching all this stuff go by can't fucking believe it. Can't believe it.
Yeah, and aspartame, I think, is amino acids. I've read about it myself, and I've wondered whether it might have a similar mechanism of toxicity as glyphosate does with respect to messing up amino acids.
That's interesting. And it's two essential amino acids it's made of.
Yes, Right. Well, the same thing with glycine. Well, glycine is not essential. We can synthesize it, but it's very, very important. It's a neurotransmitter as well as being, of course, a really important amino acid in proteins and a precursor to methyl groups. It has a glycine plays a lot of roles in the body, and glyphosate's messing them up.
Is the gly a
Yeah.
coincidence, or is it a chemical
No, that's the
similarity?
reason. It is a glycine molecule. Glyphosate is an amino acid, and it's an amino acid analog of glycine. And it is a complete glycine molecule, except that there's extra material attached to its nitrogen atom, which I think that's what gives it a really unusual mechanism of toxicity through its interference with glycine. And that's similar with this with the aspartame, that it's a two amino acids, I believe. I forget the details on that, but
Yeah, it's
yeah,
two. I
very
forget
interesting.
which the names of them, but it's two that are bonded together in an unusual
Yeah.
way that doesn't normally happen.
Yeah, so that seems pretty interesting to me because I suspect it may also be doing a substitution kind of thing, very similar to glyphosate, the concept. I don't know. I haven't done the research, but it seemed it's. I remember I was poking around that space at one point because I was fascinated by all this aspartame toxicity, which I suspect is connected to that fact that it's amino acids. Anything that's amino acids, you got to really watch out for toxicity.
I think the big moral of the story here is that people tend to get angry when you tell them that this kind of stuff is bad for them because they feel like it's their right to eat whatever they want, and then they can also pump their fist or shake their fist in the air at the capitalist system. And then when you start putting the pieces together, you're a conspiracy theorist and not a common sense person who reads scientific studies.
I know.
And particularly with autism, people are very angry that anyone would say, well, it's about vaccines, because there's a whole cult of vaccination that does not even want to look at the safety studies. They just want to take Merck's promise that's all good. And if you want to look at the safety studies, people can yell at you, thinking, can accuse you of conspiracy theorizing when no, there's a regulatory process and we have a right to know what is being injected into us and whether it even works. And what damage it causes. And with autism, I'm amazed that you can hardly have a conversation about it without someone getting angry when you propose a reason, as if we could have this wide of and radical of an effect with nothing creating it on the other end.
I know. It amazes me with autism because people get so you're afraid to bring it up, right? To discuss it because people get so angry about it. And yet, here we are with all these autistic kids and why aren't we distressed by that, you know? I mean, there are many families whose lives are really being disrupted by these autistic kids. And we're just putting up with it. We're just like, "Oh yeah, this is just expected. Of course we have this incredibly high rate. The rate just went up 10%." And we heard hardly a peep from the
Over what
media, you
time
know.
period?
It just went up 10%. There was just a new announcement a couple of weeks ago by the CDC, another 10%. It's like, oh, ho-hum, you know, who cares? I'm just amazed that people aren't reacting to autism, you know, with the
Yeah,
extent
I
of
mean
it.
the autism epidemic is devastating, and the thing is that the mainstream counter narrative is, oh, that this is just sort of neurological differences. And I sit with families all the time as a journalist and an interviewer and in the process of writing books, who are talking about, and we're talking about, you know, children who are 7, 8, 9 years old who are smearing their feces on the walls, who are banging their heads till the point that it's bloody and they give themselves a concussion, who are biting their hands. We're not seeing those kids because they're institutionalized or they're behind closed doors. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing the Gretas of the world who are saying that they have autism, and then they're a world they're contributing on a world scale talking about the problems with global climate change. And so I think that people who are in it are, you know, they're so devastated, they're so overwhelmed, they're behind closed doors. And then people who have had no problems, they say, well, I vaccinated my kids and my kids are fine. And I mean, that's a legitimate argument, right? When
Kind
you dig
of.
a little deeper,
Right.
you find out that the kids are not fine, but that's a whole other radio show.
Right.
But but they don't, they're not seeing this unbelievable social damage and that we are doing to our children. And honestly, I believe that we are all complicit. I mean, I agree with
I do
you,
too.
Stephanie
I
and Eric,
totally
that
agree with that.
we have to be speaking out against this because we can't keep hurting this number of children. It's staggering.
I agree. I totally agree.
Well, This has been what I would call the perfect interview for Applied Waves
Oh,
FM.
it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having us.
And I'm looking forward to staying in touch with you and comparing notes. And I think we who are on to these topics and are devoted should stick together.
Yes, I agree.
And then, Eric, I just want to say for your readers, if anybody is interested in reading Dr. Sinnott's outstanding, very nuanced, very detailed article, they can find it on my website, which is www.jennifermargulis.net. And I don't know if you're able to put a link.
When I publish the show, which I'm planning to do as a standalone program quite soon, if you would email me anything you want me to link, including your website, Jennifer, and books also, I'll make a nifty little, place where people can learn more. And, I think this whole scenario raises more questions than it does answers. And I think that we have the possibility of a global wake up call on the environment, not just this one allegedly separate incident is not separate. This is about the whole planet and all of our bodies that this is happening.
And all of our toxic chemicals. I mean, I really hope that does come through, that people realize the ones who are getting sick are the ones who are more exposed to the toxic chemicals.
Well, I would love to see I'd love to see that studied. I hope they're taking blood serum and keeping it. It's also the kind of thing that people are unlikely to study.
Oh, I know. There's lots of pressures not to go there, right?
All the pressures
the
not to go there.
The industry doesn't want us to know that.
Yeah.
Right. I hope studies will be done. And there have been some interesting just statistical analyses of who gets sick coming out of China, as I said. And they're seeing all these comorbidities, the increased risk for people with high blood pressure or people with dementia even, people with diabetes. I mean, all these people that have these diseases that glyphosate's causing are more susceptible to a bad outcome with COVID-19.
I published it, I think the diabetes number was astonishing. There was something like between, it was either half or 57% of it was either hospital admissions or ICU admissions were diabetic.
Yeah, that is shocking.
That's how crucial.
High blood pressure is another one, and that might be the ACE inhibitor drug that many people are taking.
Oh,
because that apparently increases the receptor for virus to get in. The ACE inhibitor, which is a very common drug that people take for blood pressure control.
Are you talking about Lipitor, that one, or?
Well, Lipitor is another one. That one inhibits cholesterol, and I suspect that's also. I think people are taking an ACE inhibitor and a statin drug are in increased risk to a bad outcome. Cholesterol is, LDL in particular, helps to fight off viruses. So when you have low, there was a study out of China, low cholesterol. People who had low cholesterol ended up in the ICU, and their cholesterol kept on going down after they got sick to dangerously low levels. It was being depleted because of the
virus. Consumed by the fight, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And then it would either finally go back up or else they would die. I mean, it was really, unless your cholesterol recovered, you were dead in this study. So it was pretty striking. I think the statin drugs and the ACE inhibitors are both bad, are both going to be risk factors for bad outcome with COVID-19.
Bad outcome.
All right. Well, Dr. Stephanie.
On that note.
Yes. No. This is informative.
It's a beautiful planet.
This is informative. This is helpful. And you have kind of put some meat on the bones of what I've been saying since February is that, I mean, if you saw them, I'll send you my first video from YouTube sussing out the whole situation, saying, no, you got to watch what you eat. You got to watch your immune system. We've got to watch for who's on drugs, who's on immune suppressing drugs. You've now brought in the blood pressure drugs and the cholesterol drugs as being involved. I eat an egg. I think I'm doing something good for my body. I want all those proto hormones in there. I want all that stuff in the egg yolk to feed my various
healthy, the yolk in particular
systems,
which people don't take because they think there's cholesterol in it, so they don't eat it, which is a big mistake. I mean, there is cholesterol in it, but cholesterol is good for you. So,
all right. Well, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, Jennifer Marvelous, thank you very much. I truly appreciate your time, and I'll be in touch with the presentation. Okay, so Jennifer Margulis and Dr. Stephanie Seneff from MIT. an honor to speak with them. Thank you for listening. I would remind you that the Planet Waves COVID-19 news feed, which I am personally hand-curating, this is not a mechanized news feed of any kind. This is actually an edited publication, is on the homepage of planetwaves.net, up on the upper left-hand corner. You can also tap into my newly restyled and elaborately beautiful daily astrology feature, also up on the upper left of planetwaves.net. And I would remind you that this whole project, all of Planet Waves, is sponsored by your contributions, your subscriptions, and your product purchases. Planet Waves FM is part of the Pacifica Radio Network. We're published by Chiron Return Incorporated, and right at the top of the Planet Waves FM tab, you'll see an opportunity to contribute if you can. If you can't, just please pass our work forward. And I do appreciate that you come along and visit every week. I'm planning a full show for next Saturday. It will be a busy week between now and then, with the sun changing signs and the Taurus new moon and all that exciting stuff. Look for that on Daily Astrology. All right, I leave you with one of my very favorite Sting songs about building machines that they can't control and burying the waste in a great big hole. Sting, thanks for this one. And everyone else, bye for now.